I think that there is a way to create structures that benefit people living in communities and don't displace people living in communities. Development for communities, not against them. And so that's really what brought me into economic development work and specifically community-driven development, where choices are not being made for you, but co-designed with you. And I think that's really important in flipping the harmful history of the field on its head to actually be a champion for communities.
Welcome to the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, Aging Fast and Slow. This podcast is supported by the National Institute on Aging Pioneer Award. Thanks for listening. We are Dr. Sarah Zanton
and Dr. Deidre Cruz, your hosts. For anyone new to our podcast, we speak with scientists, policy experts, and innovators to better understand aging across the life course, with a special emphasis on the sustained impact of racism on health, the impact this has over the life course, and what can be done to tackle these inequities.
We've witnessed the power of community-led mutual aid during recent crises like floods, fires, and the peak of the pandemic. But mutual aid is not limited to immediate emergencies. For centuries, humans have shared resources, really since the start of humanity. In this century, it's often to redress economic inequality. Today, a diverse array of organizations seek to fundamentally restructure housing, care, labor, food, and more. Unexpectedly to some, design, art, and architecture play a key role in shaping these initiatives.
To enlighten us about the transformative potential of mutualism and design, we are joined today by Marisa John, an artist and director of integrated design at Parsons School of Design, and Micah Campbell-Smith, a design strategist who leverages an anthropological and research background in her community development work. John's new book, Design and Solidarity, Conversations on Collective Futures, explores the role of design and architecture in these movements.
Welcome to our podcast, and we're so happy to have you here. Could you each tell us a little bit about your background and what's brought you to this point?
So, as a visual artist, I draw on my background as a daughter of my immigrant parents. My mother's from Ecuador, my father's from China. And I'm really interested in visibilizing the nuances of immigrant communities and working families. The kinds of people that I work with are domestic workers, street vendors, migrant workers from Mexico, stories that we don't often hear. And I use art, images, and stories to help us understand these as essential contributions to our experiences and civic life and our economy. And I think of myself in general as an ambassador. So like when I was growing up, my mother asked me what I wanted to do as an adult. And I explained to her that I like talking and working with different kinds of communities. And she said, oh, well, you could be an ambassador's wife. And I was like, no, I'm going to be the ambassador. But it turns out that I'm interested in exploring the work through art making. And so I feel like my work as an artist is really is like an ambassador. Mm-hmm. I work between different kinds of communities. Mm-hmm. I work across media. I work with different practitioners and experts, including yourself, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Welcome, Micah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background?
Thank you. I work in community development because the more I learned about structural discrimination and how that plays out in the physical realities of historically disinvested communities, I wanted to make a difference. And I think that there is a way to create structures that benefit people living in communities and don't displace people living in communities. Development for communities, not against them. And so that's really what brought me into economic development work and specifically community-driven development, where choices are not being made for you, but co-designed with you. And I think that's really important in flipping the harmful history of the field on its head to actually be a champion for communities.
Well, that's fabulous. Yeah. We're excited to have you here.
Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. So your work has been praised as exemplifying the possibilities of art as social practice. So what would you say is the relationship between art and structural resilience?
So if we understand structural resilience as the ways that communities come together to organize and build new infrastructures that enable them to thrive and overcome obstacles, I feel like art can play a critical role in the prefiguration of what could be. Mm-hmm. In other words, art helps us imagine what maybe hasn't existed, enables us to imagine new audiences to come, mm-hmm. invites us to imagine new ways of how we can share resources or interact, or reframes how we understand ourselves and each other. Mm-hmm. So art, for me, pulls apart time and space. It kind of reconstellates things fundamentally, mm-hmm. and it gives us a safe space to experiment. It's almost the equivalent of a pilot, but very imaginal. And from that, we can envision more broadly the world that we want to create.
Oh, that is so beautiful. We could just stop there.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
So could you share a specific example of how design and architecture have played a pivotal role in shaping mutualistic initiatives that you discussed in your book?
So one of the things I'm interested in my work is how we can share care, housing, labor, and other essential needs that we need for everyday life. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of really interesting initiatives around the world that we can draw from. There's a fascinating moment in the 19th century that Dolores Hayden refers to as 19th century material feminists. And these women came out of this moment of reforming American society and creating new designs and plans for co-housing mm-hmm. that also mutualizes care. Mm-hmm. One of the key takeaways that Hayden points to is that these 19th century pioneers did not create enough lines of solidarity with working class women mm-hmm. who were the domestic workers. Mm-hmm. And that failure to create and bolster solidarity was why this movement did not survive the McCarthy era, when cooperative initiatives and mutualization were demonized as part of the Red Scare. Mm-hmm. So that, for me, is an important signal that affirms really working with community organizers, domestic workers, developers, social workers, those in the medical spectrum, mm-hmm. to think about what are designs that help us understand and meet the needs of new families today, mm-hmm. and how we can overcome moments of structural discrimination and create ways that our communities can thrive.
Yeah. And as part of that, as a quick follow-up, can you tell us a little bit about Care House and how that relates? And our listeners probably haven't heard of it.
So I'll first start by describing CareForce, which is an ongoing body of work in collaboration with the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which is a group of 10,000 nannies, housekeepers, and caregivers. Mm-hmm. Domestic workers are part of the fabric of everyday life. They're essential to our economy. They enable us to have leisure and quality time with our families. And as we saw in the pandemic, without mm-hmm. domestic workers, everything falls apart. Yeah. For me, you know, now I've been collaborating with NDWA for 13 years, and throughout this time, we've been creating policy toolkits, interactive media. We created a PBS film, and we had two mobile vehicles, the Nanny Van, mm-hmm. which is a 1976 bright orange Chevy van,
nice.
And the Care Force One, which is a 57 station wagon. And with myself and my toddler, an organizer and a film crew, we traveled the country learning about solutions to the nation's care crisis. Mm-hmm. And throughout this body of work, I kept on hearing about the housing precarity that domestic workers and caregivers face, as well as older adults. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I asked myself, how could we really help shift how we value care? What would it look like if the monuments in cities celebrated caregivers. Mm-hmm. That's not something we often see. We see monuments to war and victory. Mm-hmm. We don't see caregivers being honored, and yet they're cherished and important to our lives. Mm-hmm. And what would it look like to redesign the systems that centers the needs of caregivers and their families, and then we stabilize and ensure quality care for those who need it? Mm-hmm. Around this time, I started working with Micah on a number of different projects that really dovetailed with some of the work that you've been doing.
So I think this is a great opportunity for our listeners, because this is not an area we talk about a lot. So just wondering if you could maybe give us a working definition of the way we should think about community development. And then maybe if you could share the role of mutualism that has kind of emerged in the work that you've been doing.
Okay. I think community development has replaced the term economic development because there's really a move towards community-driven and community-led projects. And so that can look like brick-and-mortar architecture, like housing, affordable housing. It can look like after-school programs. It can be programmatic. There's a really wide range. So there's normally people that work in brick and mortar development, building things for the community that the community has identified it needs, or building out programs that help fulfill other community needs that the physical buildings don't provide. So yeah, I think that would be how I define community development.
Awesome. And how, and could you talk a bit about mutualism and how that's been important in your work?
Yes, I think that the way that I have come to work is identifying what I call non-traditional community leaders. And so instead of councilmen or directors of social service agencies, we really work with people that are actually doing mutualistic activities in communities because they are more connected to communities on a grassroots person-to-person level than someone who is working like 9-to-5 professionally with them.
Okay.
And so we have begun directly funding non-traditional community leaders. That can look like a grandma who in the neighborhood everyone knows, okay, I have a job interview. Can she watch my kids? Mm-hmm. Or I'm really struggling this week. She always has extra diapers. Mm-hmm. There are people that do this work that are giving to community members that community members know that they can rely on. Mm-hmm. So we begin to fund these people directly and ask them for policy recommendations on how we can design programs that meet the need that they are filling and how to support them in doing so. Mm-hmm. So we're not looking to replace them. We're looking to actually encourage this mutualistic activity. Another big one is like coaches who coach kids for free. That's really important to have activities for kids. Mm-hmm. But when you're able to provide them with better soccer fields, when you're able to supply coaches who have been buying equipment for kids out of pocket with the funds to do so, with mascots, with better build outs of these programs, you can have a wider effect on the community that really feels like they're being touched in their day-to-day lives instead of just having someone that works a 9-to-5 that might be an expert in the academic side of it but might be missing, you know, there's a diaper shortage or food is too expensive.
Wow, that's amazing. How do you identify those people?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ways that you identify people is, one, you go to churches, you go to hair salons and barber shops. You ask, who's the person in the community that you go to? You can listen to some of the conversations that are being had. If there was something that you wanted to change in your community, who would you trust to get that done? And if football is a big thing in your community, you go to like the kids' football league and you say, like, what's the coach like? And normally they'll say the coach does a lot of things outside of the official programs. Specifically for disinvested communities, the coaches can act as almost secondary parents. And so I think the way that you go about it is big community meeting spaces, like third places, to ask people, who do you trust? And if you could give money to someone in the community that you did trust to get something really done for you, what would that look like?
Oh, that's awesome.
One thing that we are working on is a door-to-door neighborhood nursing and community health worker approach. And so that everyone, no matter their age, their you know, their stage of life, how healthy or not they are, whether they're insured or not, has universal access to a nurse and a community health worker. And one of the big discussions has been, how do you identify the community health workers? And the kinds of questions that you were just mentioning, like who would get something done, who do you trust, are some of the ways that people, you know, bubble up community health workers. One of the things that I've been thinking about in that is it's easier to find people who are related to organizations, but what about the people who are depressed or homebound or can't participate as much or don't want to participate as much? How do we do community development for people who aren't engaged in the community?
It's almost like last mile engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great way of saying it, sort of the last mile problem for engaging everyone.
I mean, we saw over and over in the interviews we did, Sarah and Micah, that the nodal person, the person who's really connected, does know the individual who is looking for a job, who's underemployed, who just needs connection. And we saw that taking place. So I think it's, again, the nodal people that see the more isolated individuals or under-resourced individuals.
I agree. I think that from a policy perspective, we do pursue nodal people. But another way that has become popular in the policy space is a dual approach. So one, it is very important through the nodal people to build trust with community members. There is oftentimes a lack of trust that will prevent people that even know about programs from going to them. The more people go to programs, the more likely you are to hear, oh, this really helped me. On the flip side, there needs to be a very good public information campaign that breaks things down to an eighth grade reading level. To have social media videos that are immediately accessible that talk about programs, to communicate the programs available, and then on the backside, also build trust with communities where trust has been lost. And so together, we find that we're able to reach people and communities that we hadn't been able to reach before.
So, Micah, could you provide an example of a specific social change movement or initiative that you think might exemplify some of these concepts of mutualism and sort of other pieces that you've highlighted?
So, I'm reading a book about Baltimore, and there was a man named Willie Adams, whose grandparents were sharecroppers, and he started the tradition for Black people to be able to get mortgages and business loans. So he personally backed Park Sausage at a time when banks weren't giving Black people loans by saying, you can take money out of my safety deposit box as long as this looks like a very traditional bank loan. And from this, people were able to buy homes and get loans from M&T Bank. This really extended to the larger community. They began to do more mutualistic work with communities. So they began to fund medical centers for Black people throughout Baltimore. And one of the medical centers was in Madison Park, and my grandfather was able to institute his pharmacy there. So when people who couldn't pay came in, he would give them their medication for free. When people were homebound, he would deliver their medication to them. And in turn, they always had fruit they would give him. He never really had to buy fruit a day in his life. But there were several community ripple effects to this. By securing the first loans, you were able to open up medical centers that were able to treat people that couldn't otherwise afford it and were able to go to people that might have otherwise been forgotten. And it really came full circle. Later in my grandfather's life, the nurses who tended him said, oh, I joined nursing because you gave my mom the asthma medication that I needed. And I decided that is the exact kind of person that I want to be. He also started the Maryland Pharmaceutical Society as a result of the funding that he got for his pharmacy that provided scholarships to Black pharmaceutical students who are seeking to get into the industry. So this one this one piece of deciding to back a bank loan for a sausage company was able to create an entire ecosystem of mutual aid within the health sector.
Wow. And for our listeners, can you say the name of the book?
Yes. Give me a second.
Sure, sure. You can take your time.
They Call Me Little Willie, which is the story of William Adams.
Great. And we'll link to that in the show notes for our listeners.
Great. Maybe I'll then bounce from there into Care House.
Okay, good.
And like, I think it kind of rolls in. So Care House is the United States' first intergenerational care-based co-housing project. I initiated it based off of my collaboration with National Domestic Workers Alliance, and I involved an architect, Rafi Segal, and a developer, Ernst Valerie, and Ernst is based here in Baltimore, so which is why our first care house is, is in Baltimore.
Plus, it's the best city.
And it's the best city. And Care House Baltimore, there is spaces for 17 older and disabled adults, for caregivers and their children. Everyone has their own individual unit, and there's more space for shared and communal programs, shared meals, and shared care. Our goals are to provide quality housing for the caregivers and their children, as well as the older and disabled adults. And by congregating or sharing care, we're able to provide sustainable jobs and good wages to caregivers. And the way that we're recruiting or bringing about Care House is the caregivers are brought on first, and they're helping to decide the residence and to ensure that it's a good fit. We're also integrating art and design, which we believe is an important part of how we can design spaces that are sensory activating, that enable wayfinding, that are homes where we would want to age in place. And we also believe in the power of art and programming, and of course, passing on and transmitting cultural values, and also, of course, providing activities that are stimulating to residents. So the fourth pillar of Care House is that we are thinking about Care House not as an isolated standalone building, but as an anchor within the community. And this community that we're building in has already indicated, even before we arrived, that they wanted to revive the neighborhood's cultural history, that they wanted beautiful facades and architecture. They indicated they wanted older individuals on the street because it stabilizes the streetscapes, and they indicated that they wanted color and light. So these are all some of the things that we're responding to in the design of what we're doing, and we see it as a project that contributes to the urban-wide health. So we're thinking about structural resilience in the term of how does the brick and mortar and the actual design, as well as the programming and the input, contribute to how the neighborhood as a whole thrives.
I love that. And in my work with older adults with disabilities, a lot of times the reason they wanted to be able to get out the door or get dressed more easily or take care of themselves was to take care of children. And you can imagine in Care House that some of the older adults and people with disabilities will be taking care of the children of the caregivers who are taking care of them. So such a beautiful mutualism example buttressed by the design.
I think one thing that's really important to know about is we see the power of mutualism during times of crisis. We saw it in the pandemic. We see it every time, you know, the earthquake and fire of San Francisco, 1907, 1911. Throughout history, it's during times of crisis when we see people organizing and mutualizing. And it's important to note that advanced capitalism is not always and not necessarily set up to survive. So we have the opportunity to build our world in ways that enable these moments of solidarity to endure over time. And I think for me, that's the power of art, design, and architecture in ensuring that mutualism and structural resilience endures for the long term.
That's beautiful. So I've been thinking a lot about the Black Panther Party breakfast program because it was my undergraduate thesis topic in the 80s, and we've just recently digitized the interviews that I did with Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale and others who are less famous. And one of the really important points that the people brought up who I was interviewing in the 80s about their work in the late 60s and 70s was the mutualism of the breakfast program and the strength that that brought to the whole community. And the design of the Black Panthers was much more about this power, guns, arms in the air, you know, power that anyone could see, kind of the power of a panther. But the underneath of what they did was all these survival programs. It was feeding children. Mm-hmm. It was taking people in homemade ambulances to hospitals when the city's ambulance wouldn't pick up Black people, and screening people for sickle cell. And the mutualism inherent in that was a big part of the power. In fact, at the time, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover said the most dangerous thing about the Black Panthers was their breakfast program. Mm. And he meant because it would expand, let them survive and thrive. So I didn't have a question. but feel free to comment.
Yeah. So, I mean, over and over in the historical research about mutualism, in the first person interviews that we did with your team, Sarah, and you, Micah, we saw over and over again that during moments when people are mutualizing and pooling resources, they create these bonds. Mutualistic undertakings also divert and focus resources on training and skill building. Mm. So the capitalocentric critique of mutualism is they don't survive. And this is really a wrong framework for evaluating and understanding the power of mutualism, because what happens is, even if something only takes place for a few years, what happens is those participants take and carry those skills and bring them to wherever they go. So it's really moments of honing leadership and advocacy that endure.
Mm-hmm. I think something that really stuck with me the most, something that you said as my professor, was that individualism is a privilege, because in my work, it has really been my experience that disinvestment forces a mutualistic bond between people. Mm-hmm. You can't actually afford to be completely individualist. You must depend on your communities. So communities are really interdependent with each other when they're historically disinvested. And there's actually a jealousy towards that because you can't recreate the bond that comes from necessity artificially. So yeah, I think that aspect of mutualism is actually fundamental to the way of life for some people and really can't be destroyed, which is why I think maybe J. Edgar Hoover felt that way.
Right. Wow.
So what advice would you offer to the next generation of people that might want to pursue similar work to what you all have pursued?
You know, I'm going to share the framework or concept or term coined by one of my professors, Czesław Wodyczko, who was my advisor at MIT, and he had this term that he would use, interrogative design. The term interrogative design flips on his head. I mean, the counterpoint would be declarative design, you know? But interrogative, interrogative design presupposes that you're using artwork or design to ask a question, to prompt a dialogue. It presupposes that art is about asking fundamental questions rather than solving a problem. Yeah. So I would pass on the advice to ask questions, and part of the hard work is to find the right question that unfolds truth.
That's beautiful. Can you share, Micah, one of the most valuable pieces of advice you've ever received?
I think when I started off in policy work, I was told that if a community's story and their actions and priorities, their policy priorities, don't make sense to you, then you are misunderstanding them. Mm. And you need to work harder to understand what's really motivating these actions and steps. And I think that I take that in my larger work, where if a story is not making sense to me, that is really on me. Mm-hmm. And I need to work harder and go deeper to understand what's really motivating that change. So that's been really effective in my work, where if you make a mistake, it's a big deal. You really got to understand people.
Thank you.
That's great.
That
Thank you so much for joining us today. From our conversation emerges powerful visions of futures guided by communal self-determination and collective well-being. Check out our website, nursing.jhu.edu/agingfastandslow, for the articles and resources referenced in the episode. And if you have comments, questions, or guest suggestions, reach out to us at agingfastandslow@jhu.edu.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, rate it, or write us a review. Special thanks to Jennifer McCord for editing and sound design, Rafe Reggie and Florentina Costaca for technical expertise, Brian Fitzek for production, and Tim Carl and Danielle Kress for web design. See you next time on Aging Fast and Slow.